This week, Israeli airstrikes on Gaza resume and what it means for Palestinians in the crosshairs.
The humanitarian situation is so catastrophic that even with a permanent ceasefire, hundreds of thousands of Gazans are going to be at risk of death as a consequence of the spread of disease.
With the joy of freedom for those who've been held hostage and released comes the emotional recovery to find their way back to a semblance of normalcy.
Many people will initially feel, unsurprisingly, a huge amount of elation, but when you've been detained for a long period of time, it can be very disorientating to come back into the sort of normal part of society.
And world leaders meet for the COP28 climate conference, the implications for millions living in places that will become uninhabitable. Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hi there, I'm Lori London in Washington. Israel's warplanes pounded Gaza on Friday, sending wounded and dead Palestinians into hospitals and residents fleeing into the streets as its war against Hamas resumed after talks to extend a week-old truce broke down. In a taped statement, Israeli government spokesman Eilon Levy accused Hamas of violating the terms of their fragile ceasefire.
By failing to release all the kidnapped women as it was obligated to do so, and kidnapped children, and by resuming rocket fire.
The United Nations human rights chief has described the resumption of fighting in Gaza as catastrophic and pressed for all participants and countries with influence to redouble efforts to ensure a ceasefire. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Türk says the situation in Gaza is beyond crisis point as more Palestinians risk being killed or forcibly displaced to already severely overcrowded unsanitary parts of Gaza. Turk added, recent comments by Israeli political and military leaders indicate they're planning to expand and intensify the military offensive and are very troubling. Turk reminded all parties to the conflict of their obligation to allow and facilitate rapid and unimpeded passage of humanitarian relief for civilians in need throughout Gaza. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Medics and witnesses said the bombing was the most intensive in the southern Gaza Strip, where hundreds of thousands of Gazans have been sheltering from fighting further north. Houses in central and northern areas were also hit. Earlier this week, the World Health Organization called for the safeguarding of Gaza's vulnerable health infrastructure, warning the war-torn enclave faces an increased risk of epidemics and challenges in detecting infectious diseases. Mike Ryan, head of the WHO's Health Emergencies Program.
We are seeing a complete collapse of the higher-level infrastructure of the Gazan health system. It is just the most basic of needs that can be met now.
And I spoke on Thursday with Doctors Without Borders pediatric and intensive care physician Dr. Tanya Haj Hassan when the fragile ceasefire was still intact to learn of the dire situation her medical colleagues on the ground are describing. As she noted then, a restart of bombing would be unfathomable.
We're hearing nothing from clinicians that are currently in the north of Gaza. The communication has been completely cut off between the north and the south of Gaza. We hear from clinicians in the south of Gaza, where 1.7 million people have been displaced, so the majority of Gaza's population. And most of my conversations with them actually just revolve around how they're doing, how their families are doing, how they're coping and surviving. And then they usually voluntarily talk about the work that they're doing from a medical standpoint. So in terms of how they're doing themselves, they're displaced. Most of them left the north with just the clothes on their back. So they describe being very cold and trying to find warmer pajamas, jackets for them and their family members as winter approaches. They have lived in various types of makeshift accommodations. So some of them were housing in schools and then had to move. Some were in tents. Some have found apartments where they're living with other families in a very small space. They have very little, if any, access to water, both for drinking and hygiene purposes. And they describe describe having very difficult access to food. And there are doctors and medical professionals whose homes, you know, some of them whose homes I've visited, and their day-to-day life, they were living in very comfortable homes. One of the doctors mentioned not knowing if her home still existed or not in the north and not being able to go back. So for the majority of Gaza's population, which has been displaced south, they're unable to go north to bury their dead, to see whether their houses have been destroyed, and to collect anything from their houses, including warmer clothes. What we've heard also from some of them that are working in hospitals in the south is that they've been receiving a lot of gunshot wounds from civilians who have tried to travel north to bury dead or to search for their loved ones under the rubble, and they get shot on the way during this humanitarian pause. In terms of what we're hearing about the healthcare conditions in the south, there are, I believe, total of around 36 hospitals in the Gaza Strip and only 7 that are still functioning. Those 7 hospitals are in the south, only one of which has capacity to conduct the kinds of complex surgeries that are needed for many of the trauma patients. So really, they're working at less than half, anywhere between 25 and 50% capacity of the pre-existing healthcare system at a time when the healthcare needs have exponentially increased, not only as a consequence of direct injury from airstrikes, which we know there are at least 20 to 30,000 injured people in Gaza right now, but also as a consequence of destruction of all the other primary healthcare facilities and as a consequence of people with chronic illnesses not having access to care for over 50 days now. So people with diabetes, people with kidney failure, people who are pregnant with complications of pregnancy or who need to deliver. So all of these people who would normally, people with cancer, who would normally have regular medical visits and have regular medical needs, have not been able to access those. And so some of our colleagues who are working in hospitals in the south mentioned seeing an influx of people who have chronic illnesses and had been in hiding from the aerial bombardment up until the humanitarian pause and are now flooding the hospitals with complications of their chronic illnesses. There's also been a significant increase in acute diseases as a consequence of the displacement of the population, the poor hygiene standards, and the lack of clean water. So they're seeing a lot of diarrheal disease illness, a lot of children who are severely dehydrated and in need of medical care flooding into these hospitals.
It sounds like the medical professionals, the doctors, are basically living with the bare minimum. What are they doing for patients that are coming in without electricity and potentially medication and ability to treat these people?
I've been wondering about this a lot, and I have a lot of questions about how they're able to treat these cases of severe dehydration, for example, when you don't have access to sterile water and you have limited access to IV fluids. So I can imagine it's extremely challenging. There is some humanitarian aid getting in, primarily to the south. It's very challenging to get any humanitarian aid to the north, and that's been one of the parts of the negotiation that have been going on between parties, is, you know, trying really hard to get aid to the north, which my understanding is Israel has been really reluctant to let aid or anything travel south to north. Most of the aid that has been coming in has been coming into the south, but it is not nearly enough, and then that is quite the understatement.
What happens when the ceasefire is lifted?
You know, at this point, the humanitarian situation is so catastrophic that even with a permanent ceasefire, hundreds of thousands of Gazans are going to be at risk of death as a consequence of the spread of disease and the lack of shelter and the lack of warmth, lack of clean water, lack of food. They have literally been stripped, excluding the violence. They have been stripped of all the things that are dispensable to human life: water, food, shelter, medical care. So to say that we've had a few days where they're not actively being killed by aerial bombardment, and what will happen when we go back to aerial bombardment, I mean, we are seeing the systematic massacre of an entire civilian population in 1,001 ways, both direct violence directed at the civilian population, but also being stripped of these things that are essential to life. So my hope is we don't go back, you know, we don't leave this humanitarian pause, that this is actually a permanent ceasefire. I think that is the only option we should consider as a human race. I don't understand how we're even entertaining the option of going back to violence after everything I've just described to you. And I don't understand how world leaders are complicit in allowing that to potentially happen and have been complicit in allowing it to happen for the last 50 plus days. I don't think there's any justification for the systematic destruction of infrastructure indispensable to a civilian population. There's no justification for the systematic destruction and attack of an entire population's healthcare system. And so I think the only option right now is a permanent ceasefire and a rebuilding of all the infrastructure needed to sustain the remaining population of Gaza, as well as obviously the unhindered open humanitarian corridors for aid.
Doctors Without Borders pediatric and intensive care physician Dr. Tanya Haj Hassan. With the truce broken and a restart of the war, 137 people remain in Hamas captivity in Gaza, leaving families in limbo as they wait for any sort of news of a plan to free the people they love. Friends and family members gathered in Tel Aviv on Thursday to honor them with a dinner table vigil, leaving empty chairs and the hostages' favorite meals. Liran Berman, brother of twins Gali and Ziv, joined his parents at the vigil and said, without his brothers, the table was always missing something.
It is not a complete dinner. It's never a complete meal. You always feel like you're missing something and you never eat the whole plate. You always keep some for them. Our heart is it's broken.
And the hostages who have been released bring joy and relief to their loved ones, but it will take some time to recover from the emotional trauma of being kidnapped and held in captivity. I spoke with British psychologist Neil Greenberg about what it will take for them to get back to some sense of normalcy.
So there's a huge variation in the sorts of responses that people have when they're taken hostage, and also varies depending on the sort of the phase of the hostage taking. So at the time they're taken hostage, there's often a huge amount of uncertainty and disorientation and terror or fear or people being scared, and that's not surprising. When they're in captivity, the way that they might respond to that emotionally or cognitively very much depends on what's happening to them. So if they're told that they're going to be released, if they're told that they're never going to be released, or they're threatened or they're mistreated, all of those experiences can very much impact on how people are when they're in detention. At the point that they're released, many people will initially feel, unsurprisingly, a huge amount of elation, but when you've been detained for a long period of time, it can be very disorientating to come back into the sort of normal part of society. What we know is any traumatic experience initially is likely to sort of lead to you having various symptoms of distress, so not wanting to talk about it, dreaming about it, maybe having nightmares, thinking about it all the time, being jumpy, being scared and distrustful. But most people find that over the first few days, weeks and few months, that most of those symptoms tend to dissipate, particularly if you're in a supportive environment. Unfortunately, there are a small proportion of people will go on and develop longer term problems. One of the conditions that they might develop is something which is called post-traumatic stress disorder. But it's worth saying that most people don't develop that condition. Most people have a period of distress, and then with the right support and letting time pass, that they recover.
Does it seem to impact different age groups differently, such as children versus elderly or young adults in their ability to cope during captivity?
So it's certainly true that what your experience is up until the point you're taken hostage can very much influence about how you deal with being taken hostage and also being released. I'm an adult mental health expert. I know about children and children's mental health, and I've got experience of hostages, but my expertise is on adults. What we do know about children, though, is the way that they cope with any traumatic experience very much depends upon how the adults around them respond. So if children get released and they come back into a family that is sensitive and listens to them and supports them, then that is likely to be a lot more helpful than coming back into a family where everyone's very anxious and watching for any possible sign that they might not be all right. And that can lead children to not want to worry their parents and maybe not provide an environment where they feel that they can be open with the adults around them.
What about those that come back and seem completely fine, that the psychological impacts emerge at some later point that are repressed in the initial stage?
So it's fair to say that after any traumatic event, including being taken hostage, most people who experience intense reactions tend to experience them within the first few hours or few days. That's the most common way that trauma symptoms are experienced. But you're right, there is a minority who can have what's called a delayed onset, where they can apparently seem quite well and adjusting fine in the early stages. And then as time goes on, something usually triggers them to perhaps, you know, a news article or something else happening with other hostages or someone talking to them about it can trigger them to become unwell. But the delayed onset reaction is much less common than having reactions that occur pretty soon after the incident actually happens.
And of course, if they come back and find out a parent or a sibling is no longer here, that they were murdered?
Absolutely. I mean, there are a whole range of factors that will influence how someone will adapt. As you said, you know, if they find out that their loved ones or their families or friends were killed in the initial assault by Hamas, you know, that's going to have a huge impact on them. They've also got to deal with the fact that actually there are people who are left behind who are still in captivity, and they have to try and make sense to themselves why it is that they've been released and other people haven't. So there are a huge range of factors. And of course, you know, this whole scenario is evolving, and what happens on the news is likely also to impact upon people who've been released as well, hearing stories about those who are left behind. Or, and that's both because they may be very upset for those who are left behind, but they also may be thinking, gosh, that could have been me.
How can families help them get back into the world? Should they go to therapy? Should they just let them talk about what they experienced in their own pace, if at all?
In the early stages after one has experienced kidnapping or any other traumatic exposure, what's important in the first few days and weeks is that they have a supportive set of individuals around them. In fact, the vast majority of people don't need and actually won't benefit from having mental health professionals come and speak to them early on. Instead, what families and friends and the community should do is to provide them with an opportunity to speak about what's happened at their own pace when they feel ready to do so. They should be gently encouraged to speak about it, but not forced to. And hopefully by having a supportive environment and letting time pass and speaking about it when you can, that should really help the majority recover. There's a great kind of dictum in trauma world is that you should avoid avoidance. And so what isn't helpful in the long term is to bottle it up and just carry on. Although it's also fair to say, because we're human beings vary so much, but for some people that might be the approach that they use and it works. But for most people, avoiding talking about distressing memories actually only leads to them continuing to affect them. So it's generally a good idea to talk, but at your own pace when you feel ready to.
British psychologist Neil Greenberg, thank you so much for speaking with us. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. The UN Weather Agency said Thursday that 2023 is all but certain to be the hottest year on record and warned of increasing floods, wildfires, and heat waves in the future. The report comes as world leaders meeting for the COP28 climate conference in Dubai bemoaned the pain of a planet in peril. Kicking off Friday's list of speakers, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged delegates to work toward a future without fossil fuels, saying there is no other way to curb global warming.
We cannot save a burning planet via fire holes of fossil fuels. We must accelerate a just, equitable transition to renewables. The science is clear.
Many of the leaders represent countries hardest hit, Kenyan President William Ruto.
We are here to affirm our commitment to provide robust support to those of us who have contributed least to climate change, yet bear its most catastrophic impacts.
Britain's King Charles made a strong plea for leaders to follow up on their climate commitments.
In 2050, our grandchildren won't be asking what we said. They will be living with the consequences of what we did or didn't do. So if we act together to safeguard our precious planet, the welfare of all our people will surely follow.
He told delegates that survival depends on reversing what he calls the frightening experiment outpacing nature's ability to cope.
Harmony with nature must be maintained. The earth does not belong to us. We belong to the earth.
Young activists attending, like Julia Hoffman, say the climate crisis is personal.
One way or another, nature is going to reclaim this planet, and I would much rather it be side by side with humans than without us. My hometown of Shanghai is always first on the list of cities that will soon be underwater.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told the Associated Press that conflicts undermine efforts to fight climate change, and climate change also fuels more conflict due to scarcity of resources and migration.
Climate change is a crisis multiplier. It increases competition over scarce resources like water, land, and it drives millions of people to leave their country.
I spoke with Michael Gerard, environmental law professor at Columbia Law School, about the global implications of climate displacement.
The World Bank has estimated that by 2050, there will be 200 million climate refugees. We're seeing extreme heat worsening, flooding, seeing weather events that are deadly and growing worse every year. There will be obviously issues that will make places potentially unlivable. What are the implications of that kind of massive number of climate refugees?
There's a huge disconnect between the number of people displaced by climate change that we're expecting and the policies of any government to deal with that. There's no legal structure to cope with people who are displaced by climate change. They are not technically considered refugees within international law. So countries don't have an obligation to take them in. There are negotiations about that, but they haven't gotten very far. So we're already seeing in the United States and Europe and other places tremendous resistance to people trying to get through the border. Large numbers of people trying to get in tends to lead to the strengthening of right-wing movements, and the people who can't get in are subject to enormous suffering. So there is very little good news to report on the front of climate displacement.
And is it already happening to some degree?
Many of the people who are coming in from Latin America are coming in because of persistent drought and agricultural failures. You know, it's the drug wars get most of the attention, but a lot of it is worsened by climate change. The Syrian civil war was worsened by climate change. A lot of people coming up from Africa. So yes, this is already happening to a certain extent.
Are there parts of the world that are really getting hit the hardest or that will get hit the hardest?
It's a profound injustice that the countries that are suffering the most from climate change contribute the least. The countries that seem most vulnerable in terms of the sheer number of people to be affected are Bangladesh, and Pakistan, some countries in Africa, some countries in Latin America, and of course the small island Pacific states. We have widespread vulnerability in lots of different parts of the world, but I think those are the areas that are the most vulnerable numerically.
What sorts of things will make their habitats unlivable?
Sea level rise is certainly going to have one major impact. Drought. Parts of Africa, the Sahel region, have suffered persistent drought, and if it's not possible to grow food, and lack of water is going to be another impact. And in the years to come, there are increasingly distressing projections about extreme heat. Already we've had unprecedented heat waves, especially during what should be the winter in the southern hemisphere and in other parts of the world. So there will come a time when some parts of the world are literally uninhabitable for periods of time unless you have air conditioning. And a lot of these places don't have much air conditioning. So that could be another driver of large-scale migration.
And you mentioned conflict and unrest. Would forced migration due to climate change, could that potentially be leading to further conflict that we're already seeing so many of around the world? Or could it exacerbate those that are already happening?
Climate change is seen as a threat multiplier, that where you have political instability, it makes it worse. That has certainly happened in places like Sudan, Syria, and other places in the world. It puts more people on the move. It puts greater pressure on public services, on food supply. It makes people angry. There are many different mechanisms, but yes, it makes the situation worse. If you have people who are forcibly displaced from their homes and there's no habitable place for them to go, that leads to a very serious situation. People are not going to quietly let their children starve. They're going to want to move to a place that is at least survivable and even better than that. Many of the places they would want to go don't want to let them in. And that is really a recipe for real conflict.
If there are no international laws in place to protect people that are being displaced literally because of climate and no longer being in a habitable situation, do you have any hope that there will be a conversation about it or that leaders will deal with addressing these challenges?
Well, the principal issue that will come up at COP28 that's relevant to this is loss and damage. The idea that the developed countries should provide money to communities that are suffering from climate change, and some of that could go help them cope with the issue of displacement. However, although there's been some progress in the UN conferences about setting up a mechanism for loss and damage, very few countries are actually coming forth with a lot of cash. The U.S. clearly is not coming forward with anything substantial. substantial, even though the U.S. is historically the largest emitter of greenhouse gases. So the pledges that have been made over the years have not been met, and they're far too low. The issue of climate displacement itself is not one of the prominent issues on the agenda for COP28, but loss and damage is.
What do you see as a potential solution that leaders should consider?
Several things. First, we need to phase out fossil fuels as rapidly as possible to get a handle on the problem, to reduce the pace of climate change. We need more work on adaptation so that people can stay in these places as long as possible. More work on water supplies and agricultural development and flood resilience and so forth, so that not as many people have to leave. But ultimately, countries of the world, especially the big countries of the world, need to accept their responsibility to take in substantial numbers of people. But so far, we've seen very few countries do that.
What would that mean for the world?
It could mean more suffering and chaos if this is not adequately addressed. There's a real prospect of significant political destabilization in parts of the world, with large numbers of people banging on the doors of countries that have lots of people who want to erect walls rather than let them in.
Michael Gerard, environmental law professor at Columbia Law School. And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, we thank you so much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.